I confess that when I chose the title of Love for the Jew, that I wanted to get something parallel to the first title. The first title, which was Hate for the Jew. But the truth of the matter is that the real title of my talk this evening is not so much Love for the Jew, but rather Admiration for the Jew. After all, how can you find a non-Jew who's going to love a Jew? You know the definition of a philo-Semite. A philo-Semite is an anti-Semite who claims that he loves Jews. And yet, I must tell you that I got into this topic many years ago when I first came to yeshiva, when a young rabbi in Springfield, Massachusetts, decided to start a journal called Tradition. And he invited me to submit an article, which I did, on the subject of the intellectuals of the ancient world and their philo-Semitism. That rabbi's name, incidentally, is familiar to us all. I'm sure you know it, Rabbi Norman Lamb. But when that article appeared on philo-Semitism among ancient intellectuals, you have no idea how much flack I received from my colleagues at yeshiva, who couldn't understand how it was possible for non-Jews to actually admire Jews. After all, we all know that Esav hates Yaakov. But you know, I think that we have to take some kind of historical perspective here and realize, some of you perhaps may have seen the exhibit at Yeshiva University Museum that just started on the synagogue in antiquity. And I think you will be pleasantly surprised to find that during the ancient period of, let's say, 2,000 years ago, the Jews were, on the whole — I'm not saying there weren't exceptions, because we did discuss that 3 weeks ago — but on the whole, the Jews were well received and maybe even flourished. I'm always reminded of that radio character, Mrs. Nussbaum. You remember, who used to answer the telephone, "No." And to a certain degree, I think that's the way Jews have answered the telephone of history: "No." It cannot be that there are people who actually like Jews or admire Jews. Now, what I want to do this evening is to consider what the non-Jews who admire the Jews found in them to admire, particularly when it came to political matters, cultural, religious matters, social and economic matters. Now, first, why did non-Jewish leaders and intellectuals alike admire Jews for their political stance? Well, one reason, I think, is that Jews had a reputation for being loyal. Jews were loyal to the state. As we all know, Jews pray for the welfare of the government. The fact is that Alexander the Great was not the first one who trusted Jews. You find that even before him, Xerxes, the king of Persia, whom we identify with Ahasuerus, actually had Jews in his army, that he entrusted the Jews with the most delicate task of guarding the border from south of Egypt, between Egypt and the Sudan. This is, as you know, something that we have actually excavated, and we have found indeed that there was a Jewish colony there at Elephantine for two centuries, who were in the most delicate position, entrusted by the Persians with guarding that border with the Ethiopians. And as we noted 3 weeks ago, the Ptolemies in Egypt, after Alexander's time, entrusted the Jews again with military affairs, particularly in the case of commanders-in-chief. There were four commanders-in-chief who were Jewish in the Ptolemaic armies. And even the culprit of the story that we're all familiar with, of Hanukkah, Antiochus Epiphanes, his father actually not only admired the Jews, but actually gave them privileges, exempting them from taxation, in the case of freedmen for a considerable amount of time, in the case of priests also. Even Antiochus Epiphanes may have, and certainly did, issued those decrees against the Jews in Eretz Yisrael, but he didn't do so in Syria, where there were a tremendous number of Jews. We estimate perhaps 1 million Jews. Again, perhaps because he realized that Jews were loyal on the whole, and if indeed he took measures against the Jews of Eretz Yisrael, it was primarily because the high priests themselves egged him on. We find that the Jews had a reputation for respect for the law, and this was, I think, particularly impressive to antiquity as it is in our own day, because there were so many people who didn't observe the law. We find that the Jews had a reputation for observing the law, for being loyal to the commanders, for paying their taxes and so on. And at a time, again, when other people, in many, many cases, revolted. Now, it's true that Jews themselves revolted on 3 occasions, and that sounds like a lot. But if you know something of the history of the Roman Empire, you realize the Gauls revolted far more, and the Germans revolted far more, and the British revolted far, far more often than the Jews. We find that, again, because the Jews were so numerous, we estimate that perhaps a tenth or more of the Roman Empire in the first century was Jewish, that the rulers realized how important that they were to the well-being of the empire. I might say that even after the rise of Christianity, Christians very often took refuge by claiming to be Jews, because they knew that the Jews were trusted by the government and the Jews were, on the whole, not persecuted. Now, one factor which I think led to great admiration for the Jews was their antiquity. Now, in ancient times, that was a very, very important point. The fact that the Jews were recognized as being an ancient people, so that even, for example, a writer like Tacitus, who lived the end of the first, beginning of the second century CE, in his work called The Histories, says that he's talking about the origin of the Jews. He says that, well, there are various theories about the origins of the Jews. And it's quite interesting to consider what those theories are. He actually gives 6 different theories. And of those theories, several of them are very favorable, despite the fact that he himself is a vicious anti-Semite. He says, for example, according to one theory, that the Jews were, he says, exiles from Crete, the island of Crete. Now, in ancient times, Crete had a reputation for being the place where the Minoan civilization had arisen around the year 3000 BCE, the tremendous civilization that was excavated by Sir Arthur Evans. Well, if the Jews came from Crete, that they must be very, very ancient. He says, they came from Crete, according to this theory, and they settled in Libya at the time when Saturn was dethroned by Jupiter. Now, Libya in antiquity means Africa, and it means that the Jews were said to have gone from Crete across the Mediterranean into Africa, that there, at the time when Saturn was dethroned by Jupiter, that would be very, very ancient times. Because the way the Greek mythology goes, the beginning of the whole system starts with Gaia, Mother Earth, and then you have the Titans, and Saturn, or Kronos, the Greeks call him Kronos, would be one of the 12 Titans. So that meant that the Jews were a very ancient people. I might say parenthetically that the Christians suffered a great deal in the eyes of the Romans, because they were said to be a very recent people. And one of the things the Christians always tried to do was to say, we're not a recent people, but rather we are an ancient people. We are the Jews. They are the wayrus Israel, the true Israel. The Romans didn't fall for that on the whole. So that's one theory, that the Jews are from Crete. Another theory is that the Jews left Egypt during the reign of Isis. Now, Isis was the great goddess of ancient Egypt. Isis and Osiris, if you know the Egyptian pantheon, these are the main divinities. To say that during the reign of Isis, the Jews left Egypt would again give them tremendous antiquity. And mind you, this again comes from one who has nothing good to say, or almost nothing good to say about the Jews. Or another theory, the Jews are emigrants from Ethiopia. Now, in ancient times, Ethiopia, when they say Ethiopia, they mean the place where the black people come from. And to say the Jews are emigrants from Ethiopia is a tremendous compliment. Why? Because from the point of view of the ancient Greeks, the black people of Ethiopia had a reputation for being the wisest, the bravest, and the most just of all human beings. Can you think of greater compliments? There certainly was no prejudice against blacks. On the contrary, in fact, if you take a look at Homer's Odyssey in the first book, when you find that a god, in this case Poseidon, wants to go on vacation, he goes on vacation to Ethiopia, because that's where he will presumably be received with the greatest honor. Another theory is the Jews are descended from the Salami, who were an ancient people in Asia Minor, and related to Bellerophon, if you know the story of Bellerophon, Bellerophontes, again, giving them great antiquity. The fact that the Jews then are connected with these ancient peoples did lead to a great deal of admiration for them. Now, some of you may have seen the article in today's New York Times, in the book review section, a review of two books, written by Mary Lefkowitz, Not Out of Africa, How Afrocentrism Became an Excuse to Teach Myth as History, and the other one, co-authored by Mary Lefkowitz and Guy Rogers, Black Athena Revisited. If you've seen that review by Glenn Bowersock, you realize there's a tremendous controversy going on now in colleges all over the country on the question of whether Western civilization really owes as much as people claim it does to the Greeks, or whether it really goes back not so much to the Greeks as to other people, particularly the black Africans and the Semites. Now, the book by Martin Bernow called Black Athena gets its title from a statement that is found in a writer named Apollonius of Rhodes, that the goddess Athena was actually born in Libya. And when they say Libya, they mean black Africa, and that she then came to Greece. And many other statements, which I'll be citing presently, which indicate that there is something to this theory that Western civilization, which we always think of as coming through Greece and Rome, may really have started in Africa and in the Near East. Now, if it started in the Near East, as indeed you'll see in a moment, there's some reason to think, then in particular the Jews get a lot of credit. Now, what Martin Bernow, who incidentally happens to be Jewish, says is that the reason why the history books that you have read and that I was brought up on don't give credit to the blacks and to the Jews is because those history books are written by people who were prejudiced, particularly in the 19th century in Germany. In any case, there is a good deal of evidence, and I'll cite some of it now. To be sure, much of it disputed, and perhaps in the question period you'll ask me about some of it. But let's start with the reputation that the Jews have for wisdom. Now, you know, from the point of view of the Greeks, there is nothing greater than philosophy. The word philosophy means love of wisdom. And the word philosophy is, of course, a Greek word. And the way it is usually presented, I'm sure that all of you were told that philosophy began with Thales of Miletus around the year 600 BCE. But the truth is that you can find that one of the very earliest philosophers, who is Pythagoras, this is Pythagoras, the famous mathematician, as well as the leader of a sect in southern Italy, and a great philosopher, Pythagoras actually acknowledges his debt to the Jews. Now, here is the passage, or here's one passage, in which Josephus, who writes a treatise against Appian, who is an anti-Semite, and defends the Jews, makes this statement: "For wisdom and piety, he," meaning Pythagoras, "was ranked above all other philosophers." In other words, Pythagoras had reputation in his own day as being the greatest of all philosophers, and I might say this continued even beyond his day, and I might say even that he was even regarded as greater perhaps than Socrates himself, who was regarded as the fountainhead of all the later philosophers. The fact is that Pythagoras had this really tremendous reputation as a philosopher. I might say parenthetically that if you know the dialogue by Plato called the Phaedo, in which remember, Socrates is about to die, has been convicted, remember, and has to suffer the death penalty. And the last day of his life, when he is thinking of the most important things in the world that he could possibly think about, has a discussion with two Pythagoreans, Simmias and Cebes, on the question of the immortality of the soul. Right? This is the most important topic, and the people with whom he discusses it are two followers of Pythagoras. Josephus says, now I might say one other thing about Josephus here. You have to be very careful when you're dealing with Josephus. One has to suspect him, but one has to respect him. Now, you find that because he is writing a work which is what we call an apologetic work. In other words, he's defending the Jews, and he's attacking those who are critical of Jews. He has to be very careful, because if he's not going to be careful, he is going to be ridiculed. How can you be attacking everybody else when you yourself are subject to some of the same charges? So I think he's careful, especially careful in this work. And he makes this statement in this work against Appian. Pythagoras, he says, not only knew of the institutions of the Jews, but was an ardent admirer, and the Greek word which he uses is the word which means zealous admirer. He was a zealous admirer of the Jews. And then he proceeds to cite a historian named Hermippus of Smyrna, whose work unfortunately is lost, but again, even though it's lost, one has to assume that Josephus did have it, and it was available to those who wanted to check up on him. He cites Hermippus as saying, and he says, Hermippus, known as a careful historian, says, Pythagoras adapted from the Jews and the Thracians three precepts, three things that he learned from the Jews and the Thracians: not to pass a certain spot on which an ass had collapsed, to abstain from thirst-producing water, and to avoid all slander. Now, these are three things that he learned from the Jews and the Thracians. I might say that there's a big question: how much did he learn from the Jews, how much did he learn from the Thracians? But you'll see in a moment that it was from the Jews, because there are other writers who have similar statements about Pythagoras, and that he learned from the Jews. And then he adds, Pythagoras introduced many points of Jewish law into his philosophy. There's a writer in the first century BCE named Antoninus Diogenes. Again, his work is lost except for fragments. Pythagoras, he says, visited the Jews and learned from them the exact knowledge of dreams. Quite interesting that you have this remark, and we'll see this again and again, that the Jews are praised for understanding dreams. In antiquity, the ability to interpret dreams was regarded as being the greatest part of wisdom. And I assume that somebody like Antonius Diogenes had heard about Yosef interpreting dreams in Mitzrayim, or some other, or maybe Daniel. He probably knew this reputation the Jews had for interpreting dreams. Even a Christian like Origen, who lived in the 3rd century, and who certainly is no great lover of the Jews. On the contrary, Origen writes a treatise against a man named Celsus, who was a pagan, and who, on the whole, defended the Jews, and Origen certainly attacks the Jews. Origen, however, says, Pythagoras brought his own philosophy from the Jews to the Greeks. He admits that. And, of course, you may say that the reason why he does that is because he then wants to say that the philosophy that Pythagoras brought from the Jews to the Greeks is the philosophy which the Christians, of course, have adopted. But still, the fact is that he acknowledges that it comes from the Jews. You may say that, some of this is on the basis of fragments and so on. There is a writer whose work does exist, not in fragmentary form, but in complete form, named Diogenes Laertius, who lived in the 3rd century and wrote biographies of the famous philosophers. And he says that Pythagoras's condemnation of the use of images was due to Jewish influence. And that's quite remarkable, because after all, the pagans certainly had images. Their gods were represented in just that way. So there you have Pythagoras, this tremendously famous philosopher, as the one who influenced the Jews in more than one respect, with respect to specific laws, for example, and in other respects as well. Now, there's another writer named Numenius of Apamea, who lived in the 2nd century, and who was quoted by a Christian writer named Clement of Alexandria. He says, and he was incidentally a Pythagorean, a follower of Pythagoras, even though this is many centuries after the time of Pythagoras, here is somebody who still follows his philosophy. He makes a statement which I might say is repeated in several other writers as well. What is Plato, he says, but Moses speaking in Attic, meaning the dialect of Greek that was spoken in Athens. Moses is nothing more, he says, Plato is nothing more than Moses speaking in Greek. Now, to say that, you have to understand that Plato was the most popular of all the philosophers in antiquity. We have found a tremendous number of papyri, for example, containing portions of Plato. So to say that Plato, in effect, plagiarized from Moses is quite a statement. And he then goes on and he actually quotes from the Torah, of course, in the Greek translation, the Septuagint. He quotes the prophets also in various passages as well. So you have then the debt of the Greeks, in this particular case, Pythagoras and Plato, to the Jews. And then the third great philosopher is Aristotle. Now, here you have a statement which is to be found again in Josephus' work against Appian. He tells of a meeting that Aristotle had with a Jew. A Jew came to Aristotle in Asia Minor, he says, wanted to find out whether Aristotle really deserved the reputation that he had. And Aristotle then is quoted by his student, Clearchus of Soli, as saying the following, "The Jews are descended from Indian philosophers." Now, to say that the Jews are descended from the Indian philosophers is giving them credit on two scores. Number one, that they're philosophers, and that's a tremendous compliment. And the other is to say they're descended from the Indians, because the Greeks had tremendous respect for the people of India. They thought the people of India had tremendous depth, profundity. He goes on. "Their city has a remarkably odd name, Hieresalume." I suppose that means Jerusalem, right? And then he goes on and says that the Jew who came to Aristotle in order to find out whether Aristotle deserved his reputation for wisdom, he says, not only spoke Greek, but had the soul of a Greek. Again, a tremendous compliment. He came to test our learning, but it was rather he who imparted to us something of his own. Now, you can imagine Aristotle admitting that he learned more from this Jew than the Jew learned from him. And then he proceeds to praise the Jew for the great and astounding endurance and sobriety. The Greek word which is used is sophrosune, which means moderation, the idea of temperance, a great quality incentive for the Greeks. Those of you who have been to Delphi, you realize that there were two inscriptions in Delphi. One of them was "nothing in excess," and the other was "know thyself." Nothing in excess. The Greeks had a tendency to go too far, so they had to be reminded. And here is Aristotle saying, here is a Jew who knows that one should not go to excess. In his manner of life, and the Greek word which is used is diete, which it gives you the English word diet. In other words, in his diet and whole manner of life, this Jew showed moderation. You know, when you think about it, here we have the three great philosophers, Pythagoras, Plato, and Aristotle, all praising the Jews. And in connection with Aristotle, I must tell you that it's particularly remarkable that Aristotle should compliment a Jew in view of Aristotle's view pertaining to non-Greeks. Aristotle says that Greeks should rule over barbarians. Barbarians means people who don't speak Greek, people who are not the Greek. So he says they should rule over them. And here he admires someone who is not a Greek. And he advises Alexander, his student, remember, Alexander the Great, to have the same attitude toward barbarians as toward animals and plants. And yet he admires the Jews. One wonders how Aristotle, who after all is the founder, many would say, of logic, could have made the mistake of generalizing from one case. I mean, he met one Jew and he generalized that Jews are a nation of philosophers. How could he do that? And one also wonders, incidentally, how he could have thought that the Jews are philosophers when, as we know, the Bible is not a book of philosophy, and for that matter, the Talmud is not a book of philosophy. I mean, I always think, you know, of the time when I received my PhD, and my mother, Alea Shalom, who of course wanted me to become a doctor, but not that kind of doctor, but a real doctor. I remember her saying, "Was war Krankheit is philosophy." Doctor of philosophy. The fact is that what do Jews have to do with philosophy, right? And there you have it. The three greatest philosophers of the Greeks, or certainly of some of the greatest philosophers of the Greeks, admiring the Jews. But that's not all. You find that they admired also Jewish leadership. Now, when I say Jewish leadership, in antiquity, if you take a look at Plato's Republic, which is probably the most influential of all the works of Plato, and maybe of all the works in Greek literature, you see that it is constructed along the lines of the four cardinal virtues. In other words, there are four virtues which are considered to be so important that they are cardinal virtues: wisdom, courage, temperance, and justice. Now, what you find if you go through the passages in Greek and Latin literature pertaining to the Jews is that it is precisely those four virtues that are praised in the Jews. Now, I've already dealt with the question of wisdom, right? Philosophical wisdom. And if you take a look at a writer like Hecateus of Abdera, who lived around the year 300 BCE, and he admires the Jews because of these four cardinal virtues. And in particular, I might say, in antiquity, they always thought in terms of the leader. In other words, what kind of leader did, let's say, the Spartans have, who taught them their lifestyle, Lycurgus? And what kind of leader did the Athenians have who taught them their lifestyle, Solon? And what kind of leader did the Jews have? So Hecateus of Abdera says, well, they had Moses. Now here's what he says about Moses. Moses, he says, was outstanding for his wisdom and courage. Quite interesting, incidentally, that you find in this particular writer that Moshe Rabbeinu is praised not only as a wise teacher, but also as a great warrior, a fighter. And, of course, we're all familiar with that fact that he, well, we of course see it in the Torah, that he is the one who inspires his people and who leads the people, actually, in military matters. If you read the pages of Josephus, incidentally, in his paraphrase of the Bible, you'll see that he even goes much further than that. Moses is presented as being a great fighter, so much so that the Egyptian Pharaoh hires him to fight against the Ethiopians. So Hecateus admires him for wisdom and courage, and then he goes on. Moses, he said, divided the Jews into 12 tribes, since this is regarded as the most perfect number. Now, between you and me, whether 12 is the perfect number or not can be debated. But what's interesting is that he regards this as a tremendous achievement of Moshe Rabbeinu, that he decided to divide the Jews into 12 tribes. Now, you and I know that that's not so, that the 12 tribes certainly antedate Moshe Rabbeinu. But the fact they ascribe it to Moshe Rabbeinu is their way of complimenting him, even if they say it's not in accordance with our own Torah. And 12 indeed was regarded as a perfect number. As you know, they had a duodecimal system in mathematics, and the relationship of the numbers system and the calendar was something that they regarded as being not a coincidence. Then he goes on. He selected, he says, men of the utmost refinement and of the greatest ability to head the entire nation and appointed them as priests. He's talking about the Kohanim. The Kohanim are, he says, the most refined people, the people of the greatest ability. Now, whether the Kohanim actually are or are not can be debated, but what I'm saying is that, again, he wants to praise Moshe Rabbeinu for having chosen Aaron HaKohen and the whole tribe of the Kohanim as being the leaders. The authority, he says, over the people is regularly vested in whichever priest is regarded as superior to his colleagues in wisdom and virtue. This is the high priest. The Kohen Gadol is the one who excels in wisdom and virtue. Now, again, if you know the history of the Kahuna, you realize that certainly Aaron HaKohen deserved such an accolade, but some of his followers don't deserve that. And yet, you see again that Moshe Rabbeinu is praised for having started this system. He's also praised for requiring young men to cultivate manliness, steadfastness, and the endurance of every hardship. So again, he's a great military leader, inspires people to be courageous. There is a writer in the first century BCE whose work is perhaps less well known, named Pompeius Trogus. And I might say parenthetically that I think that there's some significance in the fact that it's not merely the famous writers, people like Aristotle, let's say, who praise the Jews, but also that you find some less well-known writers who praise the Jews. Here is one, Pompeius Trogus, who writes in Latin, and he refers to the extraordinary talent, the word which he uses in Latin is ingenium, genius, and his shrewd nature, and he's referring to Yosef. Now, apparently the word had gotten out that there was a Jew named Joseph, Yosef, who had shown tremendous talent in organizing Egypt. And then he goes on. He says, Joseph made himself the master of the arts of magic. Now, of course, what he's probably thinking of is that Yosef was skilled in interpreting dreams, which again made a tremendous impression upon them. And indeed, he says that he was the first to excel in interpreting dreams. Now, what you find is that there are a number of writers who are concerned with rhetoric. And in ancient times, there were two subjects, really, that you might say were subjects of higher learning. One was philosophy, and the other was rhetoric, the ability to speak, to convince people. And I say, in philosophy, there's plenty of evidence. People like Aristotle, I might add incidentally, Aristotle's successor, Theophrastus, Megasthenes, there are others as well. And then in rhetoric. Now, you think of the Jews as excelling in the art of speech? Well, here is a writer named Longinus, or I should say Pseudo-Longinus, because we think his name is not Longinus, who wrote a work in the first half of the first century on the sublime. And this is the next to the most influential work in literary criticism that we have from all antiquity. And he gives four examples of what he calls the highest style of writing. And the fourth example and the climax comes from the Septuagint, from the translation of the Torah into Greek. And here's what he says. A similar effect, meaning a sublime style, was achieved by the lawgiver of the Jews, no mean genius. That's quite interesting that he doesn't even bother to name him, as if to say everybody knows about Moses, right? He's no mean genius. For he both understood and gave expression to the power of divinity as it deserved. When he wrote at the very beginning of his laws, and I quote his words, God said, what? Let there be light, and there was. Let there be earth, and there was. In other words, he paraphrases from the very beginning, or near the very beginning, of Sefer Bereishis, Yehi Or. He thinks that is very, very effective in terms of style. Seneca, the younger, who was the right-hand man of the Emperor Nero, very influential philosopher, Stoic philosopher, very influential dramatist, certainly, and great influence, I might say, on Shakespeare in later times. Seneca was no great admirer of the Jews. On the contrary, he says the Jews are a lazy people. They spend 1/7 of their lives in idleness. And yet Seneca, the same Seneca who has these snide remarks about Jews, is quoted by Augustine. Now, Augustine, as you know, is a Christian in the City of God. He says, the Jews know the reasons for their rites, while most other peoples go through a ritual not knowing why they do so. And those Jews apparently are so well educated that they know the reasons for their commandments. I suppose this means, this is my understanding, that the Jews not only did what they were supposed to do, but they understood ta'ameha mitzvot, the reasons for the commandments. And he admires that very much because the pagans apparently didn't know. Jerome, incidentally, who lived in the 4th century, again a Christian, of course, and no great admirer of the Jews at all. On the contrary, even though he learned so much from Jewish teachers, fact is that he has some very, very negative things to say about Jews. And yet, he himself says the following. He says, Jewish women undergo great sacrifices to provide religious teachers for their sons. In other words, he praises the Jewish system of education. And then he goes on. He says, Jews go to great lengths to strengthen their memories. Now, you know, in antiquity, as I think in our own day, memories were cultivated and admired. If you had a tremendous memory, you were obviously a great scholar. So he goes on, Jews go to great lengths to strengthen their memories. In childhood, they acquire the complete vocabulary of their language, and they learn to recite all the generations from Adam to Zerubbabel, in other words, from the beginning to the end, with, he says, such accuracy and facility as if they were simply giving their own names. In other words, they memorize all the generations, the whole train of generations. He then goes on and says, every synagogue has its library, from which books are able to be borrowed. Now, can you imagine in antiquity libraries? How many people had libraries, let alone institutions had libraries, and where you can borrow books from those libraries, right? That sounds a very, very modern idea. He admires that, because quite obviously that was not true among the Christians or among the pagans. There's a writer named Pausanias who lived in the second century who writes a travelogue of Greece, and in it he mentions the Hebrew Sibyl. Now, those of you who are acquainted with Virgil in the Aeneid, in the sixth book of the Aeneid, Virgil has a guide for Aeneas when Aeneas goes to the lower world. And who is the guide? The Sibyl. The Sibyl was regarded as a great prophetess, one who was in the service of Apollo, the god Apollo. So to say that there was a Hebrew Sibyl is to say that is to admit that the Jews have prophecy. Now, there's a Christian writer in the second century named Justin Martyr, again, certainly no great admirer of the Jews, mentions the charge of deicide incident. The Jews are guilty of deicide. But on the other hand, he admits, he says in this dialogue with Trypho, he says, Jews always manage to hunt up their opponents' weak points, like flies that settle on sore places. Jews are excellent, apparently, in argument. There's a writer in the 3rd century, again a Christian, named Origen, certainly no great lover of the Jews, says the following. It is possible, he says, to see an entire nation. Now he's talking about all the Jews. Some people may say, well, after all, there are certain Jews perhaps who have great memories or who are very wise. But here is Origen talking about all the Jews. It is possible, and he lived, I might say, in Caesarea, in Eretz Yisrael. It is possible to see an entire nation studying philosophy. Now, of course, again, he thinks philosophy in the sense of wisdom generally. And in order that they might have leisure to hear the divine laws, the days called Sabbaths and their other festivals were instituted. In other words, he says that the reason why Shabbat and Yom Tov was instituted by the Jews was that they should be able to study on those days in particular. And then he goes on, if anyone were to study carefully the society of the Jews in their early days, when the law was given, he would find that they came closest, he says, to leading a godlike life in avoiding the making of images, in living chastely, in showing respect for law and order, and in devoting themselves to the study of the law, to observing the sacrificial system with its countless symbolic explanations for those learned enough to understand them. What a compliment coming from one who, as I say, had no great love of the Jews at all. But to say the Jews stand for living a chaste life, living a life of respect for law and order, again, when there was no law and order. We're talking about the 3rd century, when, if you know the history of the Roman Empire was falling apart and there was very little law and order. But he admires the Jews, admits the Jews have that. There's one writer, incidentally, a pagan writer in the 3rd century, who is what we would call a Neo-Pythagorean, a follower of Pythagoras, and a Neo-Platonist combined, named Porphyry. And he, again, admires the Jews, and in particular admires, he picks out one law in particular which he admires very much among the Jews. He says the biblical law that does not allow one to take the parent bird with the baby birds, right? He admires that. Apparently he thinks that that shows great humanity and that that should be incorporated in the system of law is something that he admires. Now, one of the sciences, perhaps the queen of the sciences in antiquity, was astronomy. And the Jews were said to excel in astronomy. We find that Hadrian, now this is of course the terrible Emperor Hadrian, who was responsible for putting down the Bar Kokhba rebellion so ruthlessly. Hadrian says there is no chief of a synagogue who is not an astrologer. In other words, every head of a synagogue is an astrologer. Of course, they did not see any distinction between astronomy and astrology. And then there's a writer in the second century named Vettius Valens, who says Abraham was the most wonderful authority on astrology. Apparently they knew the statement that Abraham looked at the stars, was told to look at the stars, and the Jews would be as numerous as the stars. So Abraham comes out as an astronomer, an astrologer as well. Firmicus Maternus in the 4th century likewise says that Abraham was a great astronomer and astrologer. The Jews were known for their ability to exercise magical spells. I suppose by that they mean that the Jews had some knowledge of the occult. And you find this again even in writers that do not otherwise admire the Jews. Satirists, for example, like Juvenal or Lucian. But again, if you take a look at the papyri that we have found in Egypt, you see that there are a number of papyri which have magical spells and so on, in which the name of Moses figures very prominently. So, and magic, I might say, was a kind of bridge in antiquity from the ordinary person to the intellectual. Now, I say that the Jews have a reputation for wisdom in all its ramifications. They have a reputation for courage. Hecateus praises Moses for his courage, as we've seen. Dio Cassius, who lived in the 3rd century, again, a writer who has the account of the war against the Romans in the year 66 to 74 and the Bar Kokhba Rebellion, Dio Cassius admires the courage of the Jews in defending Jerusalem against Titus, and also their courage in the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. We find that Porphyry, the 3rd century, admires the Jews. He says that they will suffer death rather than transgress their laws. We've already commented upon the reputation for temperance, that Aristotle admired the Jew that he met in Asia Minor. And finally, justice. You find that Pompeius Trogus in the 1st century BCE even Tacitus, who hates the Jews in the beginning of the 2nd century, admires their trustworthiness to one another. There's a Roman emperor named Alexander Severus, who lived in the early 3rd century. According to the work known as the Historia Augusta, he used to explain what he had heard and retained from certain Jews or Christians. And what did he hear from Jews or Christians? What you do not wish done to yourself, do not do to another. Now, you and I know where that comes from, right? That is, of course, Hillel in Masechta Shabbos. And incidentally, the fact that it's stated that particular way in the negative shows that it comes from Hillel rather than that it comes from a Christian source, which would state it in the positive. And Alexander Severus quoted this, and then he inscribed it on his palace and in his public works, apparently in admiration for the Jews. There's a writer in the 1st century BCE who was extremely influential, who was called the most learned of the Romans. His name was Varro. Now, Varro is quoted, this particular work happens to be lost, but is quoted by Augustine. And he says the following. He says that for more than 170